Well, thank you, Eric, and I hope you can hear me all right on this. If you can't hear me in the back of the room, I'll stand up. But it struck me that since we had a small room, we might as well keep this pretty informal. And it's also appropriate that we're in this room because if you notice that the walls are full of quotes about leadership. In fact, I was sitting in this room a couple of years ago, and I was quite taken by this quote from Lao Tzu, which is 630 BC, if I remember it correctly. And I use it as an opening quote at the start of this new book that I've done, The Powers to Lead. And I pair it with a quote from Machiavelli, which is in a very much more of a European tradition. What Lao Tzu says there essentially is the best leader is the one who is so behind the scenes, uses so much soft power that nobody even knows his name. And Machiavelli, of course, writes around 1517 or so in a much different tradition in Europe in which he says that it's better to be, for a prince to succeed, it's better to be feared than to be loved. So they're quite striking bookends, if you want, for thinking about leadership. In any case, what I'd like to do for the time we have, hour and 15 minutes, I guess, that it is maybe lay out some ideas about leadership for you that are in this new book that I've written, and then throw it open to you. So I'd like to spend more of the time in conversation, which is more interesting to me. I've heard myself talk before, but I'd be much more interested to hear what thoughts you have. But to get the conversation started, let me say a few things. I wrote this book, The Powers to Lead, because I decided to teach a course at the Kennedy School on leadership after I stepped down as dean. I figured after all those years of practicing it, I ought to try to say, what could you do in teaching leadership? And I looked for a book that was short, analytical, and readable. And I couldn't find one. I found lots of books that were short and readable. Who Stole My Cheese, The Leadership Habits of Attila the Hun, and much of it coming out of the business literature, sold in airports. And I found lots of things that were very analytical and very long, written by theorists of organizational behavior, which were totally unreadable. And so I decided I'd try to write one myself to say, what should an intelligent layperson or one of my students know to understand leadership? And basically, leadership, which is the ability to help a group define and achieve its objectives, is a composite of three things. It's sort of a triangle. There's the leader, who we tend to focus on. There are the followers, as they're called. And then there's the context. And I think one of the things that I make a particular point about is the importance of context, which is often neglected. Just to dramatize this in your own minds, imagine great leaders of the 20th century. Among the ones you'd probably put on your list of the top 5 or 10 would be Winston Churchill. And some people say he was the greatest leader of the 20th century. But anyway, he'd rank up there near the top somewhere. Now, if we were asking you in January of 1940, will Churchill be one of the great leaders of the 20th century? You would have said, assuredly not. Churchill was regarded by then at that time as a washed-up backbench member of parliament. The British Conservative Prime Minister at the time said, oh yes, there's Winston, but nobody listens to him. By June of 1940, just 6 months later, Churchill was the man of the moment. He was the great charismatic leader who rescued Britain. Now, what happened in 6 months? Did Churchill change? Not one iota. What changed was the context. Hitler invaded France through the Ardennes, drove the British troops into the sea at Dunkirk, and all of a sudden the followers, the British people, who thought of Churchill as too reckless a cowboy to be the leader in January, he was now exactly the man they wanted by May, and certainly by June. But the interesting sequel to that story, of course, is that 5 years later, with the war largely won, the British people vote Churchill out of office. because they no longer want the leader who's going to win the war. That's been done. They want the leader who's going to develop a welfare state. And Churchill doesn't seem quite the right person for that. So the importance of context is well dramatized by the Churchill example. And any time we think about leadership, we have to think about context. In fact, there's a whole chapter in my new book, which I call Contextual Intelligence, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a bit. But I think there's another problem, which is that as we look at leadership, at least in the United States, we have a tendency to think about it and talk about it in somewhat impoverished terms. We tend to think about leadership as the commander. President Bush has said, I'm the decider. It's the view, this is the king of the mountain. This is how where leadership is determined. And we don't spend much time thinking about the ability to get others to do what you want through attraction or soft power rather than the hard power of command, of threatening to reduce your salary or to fire you or whatever. And I think that is unfortunate because it leads us to a somewhat truncated dialogue about leadership and in this country. We think so much about who the leader is in terms of this industrial age metaphor of the person on top of the hierarchy, that we don't think much about the nature of leadership in a networked world, which is what we're inhabiting now in this country and in most democracies, modern democracies. The traditional view of leadership, then, is what you might call the big man theory of leadership. Thomas Carlyle, writing in 1840, argued that find the largest and greatest man in the society and give him power and all else will be taken care of. There is a residue of that. For example, Bob Kaplan, who I think will be here later this week, has written an interesting book about warrior leadership. And he argues that that our inheritance of from wars and leadership in war has imprinted in our minds this need of a warrior leader. And he argues that that requires a certain pagan ethic that goes with it, a willingness to be tough. But the thing that's inadequate about that is if you think about it, today's warrior does a lot of other things besides fighting. Indeed, most generals use words more than swords. Sort of the image of Achilles is not the right way to think about it. And in practice, what we see is that a lot of leaders today, even in Iraq, have to combine hard and soft power. They have to be able to, I mean, if you look at Petraeus's strategy, General Petraeus's strategy for counterinsurgency, it's not just breaking bones and breaking things. It's also winning hearts and minds. And so that view of leadership is the tougher, the better, I think, misserves us. Now, it's true that there are large parts of the world where the big man theory of leadership prevails, so all you have to do is think about Zimbabwe and Robert Mugabe, much in the news this week. And most countries probably are ruled by kleptocrats and people who are brutal in one form or another. But it's not so true in modern democracies, where I think you can argue that that style of leadership has gone out of fashion. Now, some would say, don't sell short the big man theory of leadership too quickly, even for the modern United States. Did you know, for example, that on average, American CEOs are taller than other males? And did you know that every inch of height for an American male is worth about $800 in annual salary? These are the kinds of studies that sociologists and psychologists do. So this is often said to be proof that big man still matters. On the other hand, think carefully about that for a minute and ask about causation. Is the tall, handsome man CEO because he's more able or because he looks more like a CEO? We often find a lot of fire engines at fires. The fire engines cause the fire or are they a symptom of the fire? So one should be a little bit cautious about this fact that it's worth a lot to be taller, it may not mean that you're a better leader. It may mean that people think you would be a better leader. In fact, if you think back historically, three of the most powerful men in terms of their effects on human history, Napoleon, Stalin, and Deng Xiaoping, were a little over 5 feet tall. So this makes you wonder a little bit about the big man theory, but the even stronger concern about that would be the kinds of arguments that are made by the sociobiologists. For example, is a psychiatrist called Arnold Ludwig, who has argued that we can't escape the big man approach to leadership because basically it's in our genes. And he looks back at the great apes and notices that we are essentially 98.8% the same as chimpanzees in our genome. And he says if you look at the behavior of bands of chimpanzees, there's always an alpha male in control. And the struggle for who is the alpha male marks the nature of the group and is crucial to leadership. And you can't understand human leadership without realizing that this struggle for alpha male is built into us. The trouble with that thing as an argument is that there's no leadership gene. Studies have been done between fraternal and identical twins who either share half or all of their genetic material, and at how they've succeeded in terms of leadership positions in life, what they find is that you can account for about one-third of the differences in leadership by genetic background, genetic factors, and two-thirds then is nurture rather than nature. What's more, if you look at an even more determining point against this sociobiological explanation, you can look at bonobos. Bonobos were called for a long time pygmy chimpanzees. They live in the eastern Congo. The interesting thing about bonobos is that we share almost the same amount of our genome with bonobos, but what's most striking about them is that they're ruled by females, not males. So there are no alpha males in bonobo tribal leadership. There are essentially big females than big males. And in some ways, that's interesting about that is that people are now almost in certain modern leadership studies in a way of replacing the big man theory of leadership with the big woman theory. And the argument goes something like this, that in industrial society, when things were hierarchically organized, the big man theory may have had some use. But in a modern network society, leadership is not like being king of the mountain. It's like being at the center of a circle. So it's not giving orders which cascade down a hierarchy. It's standing in the middle of the circle and attracting people to you. And for that, you need soft power or attractive power, not just the hard power of command. And so the argument is that in this new world that we're entering, the network world, that the stereotypical view of women in their style may be more suited than not. And a number of articles have been written saying that women may be more suited for leadership in the 21st century, or better suited, than males. And the nature of the argument has some justification to it. There have been studies done by psychologists and sociologists that show that women do understand soft power better than men, and that what's more, that women tend to be more adept at using it. So there have been a number of articles written saying maybe we will now enter finally the age of women's leadership. But I think there's a danger with this. For one thing, sometimes women need to use hard power. And if you just treat women stereotypically as wielders of soft power, that deserves them. And there are other times when men need to use soft power. So if we resort to gender stereotypes, even if they're positive rather than negative, it limits our ability to think clearly about what you need for leadership in modern democracies. The answer, I think, is that sometimes women need to act more like men and men need to act more like women. And we shouldn't answer that by saying stereotypically gender answers. We should say, what are the skills, soft power skills, and what are the hard power skills that leaders need, and how do they learn to combine them in different contexts? And that's what I try to argue in this book, which is that there are three crucial soft power skills that a leader needs, two essential hard power skills, and then the most important skill is contextual intelligence of knowing when and how to combine them. Let me outline the three soft power skills, then the two hard power skills. Probably the most important of the soft power skills that an effective leader needs is emotional intelligence. I don't know how many of you listened to David Brooks this morning, but he was talking a great deal about this. We all think we know what IQ is. And, IQ essentially is the ability to do well in the French school system of 1890, you know, math and spatial relations and so forth. And psychologists who've studied IQ have tried to estimate how much of success in later life is attributable to IQ. And the answer they get is about 20%. There's about 80%. This is not how well you do in school. This is how well you do in life, measured later. And that means there's about 80% of success that's not accounted for. And among the components of that is something that psychologists have called emotional IQ, which is the ability to master your own emotions and to use them to reach out and attract others. If you heard Brooks this morning, he talked about the fact that it's a great mistake to say that emotions and intelligence are opposites. Emotions actually help us to use our other dimensions of intelligence. It's not one or the other. And let me illustrate that for you with a famous anecdote about Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. Holmes, of course, was in the 1930s when he met Roosevelt, was a Civil War veteran, a crusty old man who was introduced to the new president and later asked, "What did you think of him?" And he said, famously, "Second-class intellect, first-class temperament." That's another way of saying, not that great on the IQ, but terrific on the emotional IQ. That's quite important because now contrast Roosevelt with Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon probably would have outscored Roosevelt on straight IQ tests, but never had that emotional intelligence that Roosevelt had. Nixon had inner demons which possessed him, which he could never quite master. He was always paranoid about other people. His idea of reaching out to people was through an enemies list. And if you contrast Nixon and Roosevelt, you'll see how important it is to have this capacity or this skill of emotional intelligence. And I think that's probably the first and most important of the soft power skills. The second is vision, which is the ability to portray a picture of the future that gives meaning and inspires others. And there, Ronald Reagan was very good at portraying vision. If any of you heard Sean Willits this morning in this room talking about Reagan, saying the greatness of Reagan was his ability to portray optimism and to portray a picture of America which resounded with the American people, which drew people to him. And in that sense, Reagan took a great deal from Roosevelt, from Franklin Roosevelt. He was a natural inheritor, not of Roosevelt's politics, but of Roosevelt's style in terms of soft power. Now, a good vision has to balance realism and risk. That's the difference between a vision which is grand and grandiose. For example, Woodrow Wilson had a grand vision, but not the capacity to bring it to fruition. And it's interesting if you contrast the two Bush presidents, 41 and 43. Bush 41 used to famously say, "I don't do the vision thing." But he had one of the most successful foreign policies that we've seen in the last 50 years. Bush 43, of course, made great emphasis upon his vision of invading Iraq, democratizing the Middle East, and thereby getting at the roots of terrorism, but it didn't fit the context, and it turned out to be one of the worst foreign policies. Now, you're never going to find two presidents more genetically closely related than these two, but the difference in terms of what turned out, I think, was not that 41 had no vision and 43 had vision, but that 43 had a vision which was not accompanied with managerial or realistic skills that his father had. The third of the soft power skills that an effective leader needs is communication. You have to be able to reach out to others and communicate with them. And we often think of communication in terms of rhetoric. For example, think of Martin Luther King and his ability to use the cadences of the African-American church to reach out to a much broader audience and have a transformative effect. I mean, that was an example of great communication in the form of rhetoric. Woodrow Wilson used to practice his rhetoric. He said it was the greatest skill that a leader could have. But rhetoric isn't all there is to communication. And the best way to understand that is to think of nonverbal communication. And nonverbal communication, some psychologists will tell us, is a larger portion of our overall communication. And there, Mahatma Gandhi would be an interesting example. I don't know if any of you have seen a film of Gandhi speaking. What struck me the first time I heard Gandhi speaking was what a poor speaker he was. You know, here was one of the great leaders of the century and not a very effective rhetorician, but brilliant at nonverbal communication. Compare a picture of Gandhi when he comes back from England, having studied as a lawyer at the Inns of Court, all dressed up as a proper British lawyer with his necktie and so forth. Compare that with Gandhi, the nationalist leader in 1930, wrapped in a loincloth, living like a peasant. That communication from that, the symbolism of how he dressed was powerful. Then he organizes a salt march to the sea, not defying a British law quickly, but gradually marching with this group of peasants to the sea where they make salt, which was forbidden by British law, but doing it slowly and letting the attention draw to him, letting the attention build. Brilliant nonverbal communication. So Gandhi was an example of what you need for nonverbal communication. So those are the three key soft power skills: emotional intelligence, vision, and communication. But you also need to combine that with hard power skills. And there, I think the two most important are organization and what I call Machiavellian political skills. By organization, I mean the ability to manage the information flows and reward systems that are crucial for any group. And the greatest problem that a leader has is basically being surrounded by courtiers, people who want to tell him or her what they think the leader wants to think. And this is a temptation which is very difficult to escape. Lyndon Johnson, who was very effective, one of the most effective leaders of the Senate we've seen, had an extraordinary capacity to basically overwhelm the people around him, but it also shut off information. It meant that people weren't going to tell him what he really needed to know. And there's been a tendency in the business schools, which goes back to Harvard Business School in the 1970s, to distinguish leadership from management, as though they're two different things. The leader is the creative person who transforms. The manager is just this fellow who makes things run along, the trains run on time. The trouble with that view is it doesn't pay enough attention to the fact that organizations have systems which affect the flows of information. And the leader who doesn't pay enough attention to that is going to get himself or herself into deep trouble. Again, it's interesting here to take the case of the two Bush presidencies. Bush 43 had an MBA from Harvard, and he has expressed his philosophy of leadership as have a vision, pick a team and then delegate to them. But if your vision is unrealistic for its context, and if your team has divisions in it and you don't manage those divisions, and if your delegation isn't carefully policed as to whether you're getting back from these people you've picked a real accounting, that can lead to quite disastrous leadership. Contrast that with Bush 41, who, using many of the same people on his foreign policy team as 43, people like Dick Cheney and Colin Powell, nonetheless had Brent Scowcroft to manage a process so that there always were independent streams of information coming in. Nobody was shut out. Nobody was excluded. And again, I would think the result is pretty obvious in terms of the quality of the foreign policy that resulted the two. Here again, Reagan is interesting because Reagan delegated, was an extreme delegator, and Reagan's success was when he delegated to the right people. When he delegated to the wrong people, he got into deep trouble. So, for example, in his first term, he was careful to have a wide group of people in the White House who brought him different views. But then he let James Baker and Don Regan trade jobs between Treasury and Chief of Staff, and Regan allowed Poindexter and Ollie North essentially to organize Iran-Contra, and it nearly undid the Reagan presidency. So there's a considerable difference there in terms of organization in the first part of Reagan's presidency and the second part. Interestingly enough, when he removes Reagan, he brings in Ken Duberstein, he is able in the last 2 years of his presidency to recover, which was quite impressive. The other hard power skill that an effective leader needs is what I call Machiavellian political skills. And that's the ability to size up the weaknesses, likes and dislikes, preferences of other people, and to play on those to put together minimum winning coalitions to get things done. Now, sometimes people will say that that's the politics of fear, that that's bullying. But bullying, which is common in many aspects of human groups, there are two types of bullying. There's bullying which people do for its own sake, and they're what you might call bullies with a vision. Bullying essentially to push forward an agenda effectively. And sometimes in sports teams we'll see that. Bobby Knight, the legendary basketball coach, wasn't necessarily pleasant to play for, but did produce winning teams. Perhaps more intriguing as an example would be Admiral Rickover, Hyman Rickover. When you think of Admiral Rickover, we think of the father of the nuclear navy, the man who was able to create a flawless nuclear engineering system to work underwater without accident. That's an extraordinary accomplishment. And Rickover, you might think, if you don't know anything about him, was this tall, swashbuckling admiral and so forth. No, Rickover was a little fellow. He was near the bottom of his class in Annapolis, and he was able to do two quite important things with hard power. One was to set up networks to recruit resources from the Congress outside of hierarchical Navy channels. And the second was to create a structure which was very rigorous in terms of the way it disciplined young officers, but with a vision of a perfect nuclear Navy. So the bright young naval officers wanted to go work for Rickover, not because he was a nice man to work for, but because they believed in his vision and that he would get it done. So those Machiavellian political skills can be very important as well. The question then is, if I've given you three soft power skills, emotional intelligence, vision, and communication, and two hard power skills, organization and Machiavellian skills, how do you put them together? And that is the crucial question, and goes back to my opening comment about the importance of context. The sixth skill that an effective leader needs is contextual intelligence. And contextual intelligence is the ability to know how to combine these hard and soft power skills into smart strategies or effective strategies. It's an intuitive diagnostic skill that allows you to align tactics with your objectives. In some ways, it was summed up in a very dramatic way by Otto von Bismarck, the great German chancellor of the 19th century. And Bismarck once said that the role of the leader is to listen for God's footsteps in history and try to seize his garment as he sweeps by. A more prosaic, modern American version of that would be that leadership is a bit like the task of the surfer, of trying to judge the wave, not getting on your board too soon and falling off, not getting on too late and missing the wave. Now, an intuitive sense of timing is crucial. So contextual intelligence depends on understanding culture, the distribution of political power, and the sense of timing of what the needs are for the group at a particular stage. And that is a skill which I think can be developed with time. Some people say, well, the trouble with leadership is it's horses for courses. I mean, some horses run better on a dry track, others on a muddy track, and there's nothing more to say about it than that. But I think that's not quite right. I mean, there's some truth in that, but it's also true that we can be trying to develop people to understand context so they can know how to combine their skills in different contexts more effectively. I use the metaphor sometimes of Mark Twain's cat. You know, Mark Twain said that a cat that sits on a hot stove will never sit on a hot stove again, but it won't sit on a cold stove either. A leader who develops a certain set of procedures that work perfectly for this situation may not know how to adapt them to another situation. What we need is to develop leaders who have enough sense of context to know when to make that kind of adjustment. It could also be illustrated by a comment that was an answer to a question that Jeff Immelt, the CEO of GE, once made. When somebody said, well, you know, how, when you're running this vast multinational corporation, how do you know when to make the decision or not? And he said, well, that's the hardest part of the job. He said, I would say that maybe about six times a year, six times in this vast conglomerate, six times a year I say, I've listened to you all. We've discussed this as long as we're going to. I'm making the decision. I'm the CEO. He said, if I did that 18 times a year, I'd lose my best people. If I did it three times a year, the company would fall apart. Knowing that difference between the six, the 18, and the three requires contextual intelligence. And I think that's going to be the key skill that we're going to need in terms of leadership in this kind of world that I called a network world, in which hierarchies are flattened. And that's true not just for business or nonprofits or but for government as well. And in that sense, the question again is, can we teach it? Can we get people to develop these skills? What we tried to do in the Kennedy School was to use a variety of techniques to do this. But I would say it's best summed up perhaps by a slogan of the American Army, which says that in teaching leadership, you should follow three things: be, know, as in K-N-O-W, and do. Be means to understand yourself, to know what your strengths and weaknesses are, to work on your emotional intelligence and develop it. Know means to read history, to do case studies, to learn what has worked for others in different contexts in the past and what has not worked. And do means to go out and get experience. But the Army combines that with what they call an after-action review. Anytime they do something for experience, they have to write up why did it succeed or fail and what could have led to it being done better. Those, I think, are teachable skills. And if you go back to what I started with, which is that we tend to think about leaders being born, not made. We tend to think that it's something genetic, that it's the big man theory of leadership. We're missing the point that in leadership in modern democracies, what we really have to realize is it's very widely distributed through society, and we can do things to improve its quality. Most of us are leaders from the middle. And by leaders from the middle, I mean most of us have a boss above us, and we have some followers below us or subordinates, and people to either side of us whose help we need, but who have no direct control over. And if you're going to lead from the middle, you're going to have to use a lot of soft power. You have to use soft power to attract your boss to the view that you're giving good advice. You have to use soft power to attract those to right and left of you, east and west, to essentially want to help you. And you're going to have to mix soft power with hard power in terms of how you treat your subordinates. Hard power alone is unlikely to be sufficient. And those are skills which I think we can teach. Those are things that we can do something about, but we're not going to do anything about it until we get the old model out of our heads. So long as we think leaders are born, not made, that it's all or mostly genetic, that it's somehow big man or alpha male or hard power, we're not going to think in the creative terms about the leadership we need in society today. There's a tendency to think of power sometimes as a zero-sum relationship, that if I get more powerful, then you must become less powerful. No, the most effective leaders are those who align their views with others so that as the others get more powerful, it increases the power of the leader as well. And that's what takes us back to the wisdom of Lao Tzu on that panel on that side, which is the Chinese understood this 630 BC, and we're only just beginning to get it now. But let's hope we can recapture that wisdom. So let me stop there as to what I mean when I talk about the powers to lead, and throw it open for you all. I mean, this is the part that's more fun for me to hear your comments or observations or rebuttals. So over to you. Yes?
Could you comment on the different styles of leaders as on one side the leader who looks for consensus and on the other side the leader who leads and drags the rest of the people along with
him? I don't know how much people can hear the questions. Contrast the leader who looks for consensus and the one who says, here's what we're going to do, and drags others along. The most effective leaders do a bit of both. In other words, if you think about leaders as people who help a group define and achieve its objectives, if you don't pay any attention at all what the group wants, it's not clear that you're going to be able to move them in that direction. And often the hardest job for leaders is to get a group which is internally divided or perhaps complacent to rethink its objectives. But you do that by listening. You can do it by preaching. You can do it by saying, you know, I'm a prophet, follow me. More often than not, it helps to work with the group to listen to them and then to say, I think we've moved to a consensus and now let's move that consensus along. There's a tendency that sometimes when people come into a job as a university president, there's a tendency for people to immediately say, what's your vision for the university? And a friend of mine who was a university president said, the worst thing you can do is to answer that until you've talked about it with the faculty. You come in and you say, here's what we need. Unless it may be that you know what they need, but unless you talk to people, listen, and know how to express that vision of how they need to change, you may find yourself generating more resistance than it's worth. So it's not purely either or, but it's a matter of combining those two. Yes?
Since we're all having the opportunity to pick a leader of the United States in November, could you comment on our two candidates, how they utilize these skills that you've mentioned?
Well, I happen to think that any of those who may have heard the session that Sean Willens and I did at lunch, I said that I think we have produced two very good candidates for leadership. I'm impressed with both, and I wouldn't say that about all the people who started in the first 16. But it is interesting what a contrast they are. I mean, you know, you have one of the oldest candidates for president and one of the youngest, I guess third youngest. You have a man with 3 decades of experience in the Senate and a man with less than 1 term in the Senate, though with some experience in the legislature before. You have then to say, what does experience tell us? And essentially somewhat, in much of John McCain's experience has been what you might call from the top down. Much of Barack Obama's experience has been what you might call from the bottom up. Obama's experience comes from having an African grandfather, an African father as well as grandfather and grandmother, from having lived in Indonesia as a child, from seeing the world in a very different way. And then the interesting question of which of those forms of experience is going to be more important for being an effective president. And, you know, it's a hard call on that. On the other hand, neither of them has run a large organization. You know, a Senate staff is 100 people or so. And neither of them has been a governor or run a large organization. Then you look at the questions of emotional intelligence. And there, I think, one of the intriguing things is Obama seems to have, if you watch the way he handled the crises that arose during his campaign, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright and others, he seems to have been able to handle that with considerable equanimity. And what's more, sometimes to even use it as he kept his cool, but he also used it to for larger things. I mean, the speech that he gave after the Wright incidents first surfaced was really a very fine speech on race in America. McCain had a reputation for having an uncontrollable temper. And yet what's interesting is that he seems to have listened to people say, you've got to do something about that. And in the way he's run his campaign, you haven't seen that. So maybe that indicates that's something that he's been able to control. So we have quite different candidates in terms of quite different contrasts. It's interesting we have a good pair of choices. And the hard thing for voters is to say, how do I know how to make, you know, how do I put all that together? And we look for little hints that come out of biography, out of previous experiences, out of the way they run their campaigns, out of their, you know, how well they keep their temper as they deal with these things, and try to make an assessment on that as to whether this will be a Franklin Roosevelt or a Richard Nixon. And that's not easy. Yes.
Changes dramatically. And it actually was driven home for me by the fact that you cited Jeff Immelt's 3, 6, and 18. I think there's a lot of people who would say yes. Mm-hmm. So just as an example, how are we supposed to evaluate what is and what is not effective when our views of that can change so much?
Well, it's a very good question about when do you make your judgment on effective leadership. Something that may look effective or ineffective at one stage may look better later. President Bush now likes to cite the fact that though he is only 30% standing in the polls, that Harry Truman was also very low in the polls because of the Korean War. And so he has said many times that judged by history, you know, 20 years further, he will be exonerated. You can do a couple of things. One is you can ask, for example, just using that Truman Bush example, because Bush himself brought it up. You can say, well, Truman had several significant accomplishments by this stage in his presidency, such as the Marshall Plan and NATO, which Bush doesn't have. You could also say that if the Middle East turns out to be stable and democratic 20 years from now, Bush will look a lot better than he does today. But you can still, historians could still ask, what were the costs and how good was his assessment in the way he did it? In other words, if you say, as a leader, did he make the proper preparations for accomplishing these goals? Many people feel that he did not. So you can even, there's a danger of just saying success is the only measure of effective leadership. The means that are used, the costs that are incurred are also part of it, and the other accomplishments besides those of the particular point you're looking at for the success. But it is hard. Woodrow Wilson is a fascinating case Woodrow Wilson, who is now generally, I think, well regarded as a past president, when he left office in 1920 or 21, he was regarded as an abject failure. But what's more, the policies that he proposed, the League of Nations, was rejected by the next three administrations. Indeed, if you take it further, you can take it right through, you could say, for the next 20 years. Not only did the three Republican administrations that followed him, Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover, reject his policies, but Franklin Roosevelt couldn't implement his policies until after World War II started. So if a leader has a policy and it leads to rejection and to policies that are just the opposite, American isolationism for 20 years, at what point is he rehabilitated because a United Nations is created by a more successful leader who builds on the idea? So you ask a very good set of questions that historians have to wrestle with all the time. But I think you don't want to just say success, that proves that it's a good leader. I mean, there is spurious causation. Yes?
I've noticed that in our discussion so far, we've talked about leaders who come into offices that are already established. President of the United States, President of GE. What do you have to say about any particular skill set, pitfalls, opportunities that social entrepreneurs have, given that they often don't enter into established offices? And I'll just quickly read, for the sake of our group here, another very interesting quote from the panel from Machiavelli. "There is nothing more difficult to take in hand, more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success than to take the lead in the introduction of a new order of things." Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's often the case that it's harder to ask the right question than to get the right answer. That one of the crucial skills for leaders is to get a group of people to say, this is what needs to be done. In other words, most of what we find is a sense of chaos. Things are coming at us. And if somebody says, you know, we can do something about that. This could be a community organization. We could actually make the library system better. We could make the school system better if we were just to pull ourselves together. That's an extraordinary leadership. And there may be no PTA or something to be the vehicle for that. You may have to create it. Or if you take global issues, somebody sees a large issue which is unattended to, you find a large, there are a number of young people today who are saying, let's find a way to do something about this. Let's think of a way to formulate this. Or Wendy Copps, Teach for America, which grew out of her Princeton thesis, is another example. So I think it's extraordinarily important to think of leaders not by their position, but by do they help a group understand where it is, even whether it's a group at all, to set objectives and then to accomplish the objectives, not because the leader accomplishes them, but because the group organizes itself to accomplish them. And social entrepreneurs seem to be the perfect example of that. And some succeed and some don't, as you know. it's tough to take something which isn't organized and organize it, often harder than to take an... If you have a going organization, you can preside, and the absence of really creative leadership may get by. If you're having to create something, if you're not good at creating it, nothing happens. So I think you're right to point out that that's another dimension of leadership. Yes, Bob?
Could you first change the context from government to corporate? And we live in a time when big company corporate executives are getting paid 200, 300 times as much as the number of workers. How do you assess the role of charisma? Seems like that's a, kind of a high-priced commodity these days, at least in that context.
Well, it's interesting. There is a study by a friend of mine, a colleague at the Harvard Business School, named Rakesh Khurana, which he called, the title of his book was The Myth of the Charismatic CEO. And he said, what's happening in the business is boards find that the company is not performing quite as well as it wants. And so they see somebody who appears charismatic. He's got a lot of press and seems to everybody's following them and so forth. And they go to great efforts to hire this person, often overpaying them with very large remuneration. And it turns out that in the new context, the charisma is no longer so great. There's a great problem with the term charismatic. There's the famous question of John Chambers, who was CEO of Cisco. And I think it was in the year 2000 that Fortune magazine put him on the cover and said the most charismatic CEO. And a later, after the dot-com meltdown, and Cisco had lost a huge amount, I can't remember what percentage of its book value, it said, he doesn't know what he's doing. Well, you know, the problem with charisma is it's combined of three things. The person, some characteristics of the person, what the followers feel they need, and the context. And it's not... Oh, in other words, the charisma may not travel. If you think it's just in the personality of the person, but you put that person in a different context where people want other things, then the charisma vanishes. And the trouble with charisma is it's a little bit like, the Chinese had this expression, the mandate of heaven. How did you know whether an emperor was a legitimate emperor? Because he had the mandate of heaven. How did you know that he lost the mandate of heaven? Because people revolted against him. Wait a minute, that's circular. And to some extent, charisma has a large degree of circularity in it. And I think Karana's book about the myth of the charismatic CEO is a great study of that. Yes?
Out to everybody in the room, and it was a very compelling story. And I remembered having read a book by Deborah Tannen, who was a sociolinguist,
right,
20 years ago, called You Just Don't Understand.
Right.
And what she talked about, and it just went off in my mind, what he has is the ability to talk like a woman.
Mm-hmm.
As what? He talks like a woman. So when he speaks, he forms connections his success, at least in person, was this ability to not communicate in a traditional masculine way that she describes, but in this more traditional feminine.
It's fascinating. Ellen Goodman, the columnist for the Boston Globe, wrote a very nice column on this, a month or two ago, comparing Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And he said the irony is that Hillary Clinton, because she had to play against gender stereotypes of being too soft, emphasized experience and toughness, and it left the whole soft side open to Obama. So all the soft power of inspiration and the future and talking like a woman was done by Obama. And the Goodman said is that it's much easier for a male to talk like Oprah than for a woman to talk like Oprah in a political campaign. I think there's something in that. Yeah. Yes?
You talked about 41 and 43, but not the person between them. Bill Clinton is coming this week to talk to us at IBS, and he also, I think, has some of that ability to speak directly to people. So I was wondering what you thought of his soft and hard skills.
Well, Bill Clinton, I worked for him, so I'm somewhat biased, but Bill Clinton has this extraordinary capacity, just as you described, to empathize, to reach out, to communicate. And that, I think, has served him extremely well. I mean, he can make people think that he is communicating just with them. It's a great skill, and he's terrific on that. But on the overall dimensions of emotional intelligence, he's not as good on controlling his own emotions. In other words, if you look, so far as we see about Obama, we don't, you know, this is early in the process. But if you look at the Monica Lewinsky situation, it's not the sexual peccadilloes or so forth that were crucial there. It was the self-indulgence and that inability to control yourself that I think would indicate a problem of emotional intelligence. What's interesting is that he was able to develop this capacity to reach out to others, as the previous questioner is describing, though this inner part of emotional intelligence was not as well developed. With all that said, I still think he did a very good job as president. I mean, I'm trying to be an analyst, not a partisan here. Yes.
I've found over the years that new leaders are most afraid of the isolation that attends leadership, and I'm curious as to what history, what your studies have shown about how great leaders have handled the isolation that attends leadership.
One of the hardest, this goes to this point I made about organization. You have to organize a situation where you're getting flows of information where you have some trust in the flows, knowing that the people immediately around you are going to be courtiers, that that's just the nature of the beast. And that, so a new leader has to ask herself or himself, how am I going to make sure that I'm getting that information? And the best way to do that is with multiple sources. I mean, some take a single confidant. Remember, Nixon had Bibi Rebozo. Literally, Nixon found it very hard to communicate with other people, and even including his own staff of Haldeman and Ehrlichman. He had Bibi Rebozo, who we could talk, because Bibi Rebozo was absolutely no threat. But that's not what you want. What you want are people who can tell you things that you don't want to hear. And if a new leader the first thing that he or she ought to be asking themselves, how am I going to structure this so that I'm getting flows of information that aren't always what I want to hear or what people think I want to hear? And I think that's a absolutely crucial. It also includes the capacity to have people tell you stuff that's not just straight information, but about how you're behaving. And it's not just a problem with new leaders. I mean, in the leadership literature, there's what's called the Bathsheba syndrome, which is based on King David, who, of course, was a great young leader who saved Israel in the battle with Goliath. But as he rose to be king, he thought it was all right for him to take the wife of one of his soldiers. And what's more, he indulged in a cover-up and sent the soldier to the front lines to be killed. And that question of as you get more powerful and you get the sense that you're entitled to things, I'm special, I'm the leader, I deserve better. The people, you know, look what I've done for them, I shouldn't be held to the same standards. That happens, that so-called Bathsheba syndrome, and that's why it's in the Bible. And I think the crucial question for a leader, whether new or old, is how do you protect against that? How do you make sure there's somebody around you who's going to say, you know, you're not who you were. You're falling into situations where you don't even realize what you are. That's hard. But it goes to this point about what I call the hard power skill of organization. A good leader organizes to protect himself or herself against that. Bob, I should let the man behind you have a shot first. Yes, here. Yeah.
The skill of listening well How important is that for leaders? You talk about Obama being a good speaker. He so happens to be a very engaging listener. And the question, how much does that pay in terms of leadership and you've seen political leadership?
Well, I think listening is absolutely crucial. In other words, if you're not listening, you're going to have streams of information which are only the ones that are sent to you. And so I think listening, that feeling of how to reach out and hear is absolutely essential. And I think from everything I've heard described, Obama is quite good at that. Bush 41 was also very good at that. In other words, as I've heard it described by Brent Scowcroft, 41 would ask to have people brought in to brief on things which weren't necessarily what he wanted. You know, and he was very good on that. And a contrast, again, to stay within the Bush family, is after 43 fired the J. Gardner, General Gardner, who was the first Reconstruction czar in Iraq. Gardner was brought back to the White House for an exit interview. And according to Bob Woodward, Bush talked to him about football. Here's a man who's just come back from the field in what is possibly one of the disasters of your presidency. And instead of asking him detailed questions, which you may not have to respond to, you may not have to agree to, but saying, how does it look to you on the ground, they start discussing football. That's a missed opportunity for listening. So I think that's sort of a dramatic example, but listening is crucial. Bob?
Change context again. I'd like you to imagine that you're advising whoever the top guy in the Catholic Church is in the United States and speaking of sexual behavior that goes on in a series of problems. What combination of hard power, soft power,
Well, it's an interesting, I mean, it's a very real case. I don't know if you know Father Brian Hare, who was former dean of the Divinity School at Harvard, and who was advisor to the Archbishop of Boston. But it's interesting how the church in Boston was severely disrupted by the sexual scandals. Somebody like Hare would advise the new archbishop that the splendor, pomp, and dignity of the church is not what you need at this time. You need to show humility, you need to show understanding, and so forth. And it was intriguing to me that when Pope Benedict came to the U.S., somebody had obviously clearly advised him to make some statements about apology and contrition on this, which I think were very effective. In other words, if he had simply, in all his great regalia, had visited the United States and not dealt with that, I think it would have been very bad for the church. But clearly some bishops, archbishops in the American hierarchy or perhaps in Rome had said to him, you cannot go to the U.S. and brush this under the rug. You have to deal with it head on. And I'm told by Catholic friends that did have some effect, that it was something which they thought was effective leadership. Yes?
There's a very provocative book that was written a few years ago called Fooled by Randomness by a guy with a background in the financial markets. And the key point was that we're very prone to get fooled by patterns that we see. And that he claimed that Wall Street, in particular the financial world, was populated at higher levels by people who've just been the beneficiary recipients of good fortune. And that as you go up the hierarchies of these organizations, it gets harder and harder to assess the actual quality of the people or their decision-making and their effectiveness, because the events that they encounter generally are not repeated very frequently. In contrast, the people at the bottom of the hierarchy, like the lady working in the cafeteria, you can very quickly and very easily assess her performance. But the higher you go, the more difficult it is. And as a result, he's very cynical about the quality of leadership in corporations. And then when you see what's played out, particularly in the financial world, over the last year or so, where it appears the leadership were managing these huge organizations and managing, supposedly being responsible for managing their risk portfolios, and to a non-financial person seemed to be spectacularly inept at that task. And I just wonder, when we're discussing leadership, we tend to look at these things that are very quite subjective, but we don't necessarily apply objective criteria or objective modalities. And so Malcolm Gladwell quotes in one of his books about the Munich Orchestra, where they did a blinded audition, and the 90% of the people, or 90% plus, were all male. But they did a blinded audition, and they, to their astonishment, they found out that the best person for the role in question was a diminutive woman who was already a member of the orchestra and was under their noses. And it shocked them. So the, in a roundabout way, there's this problem of subjectivity and assessment. And it doesn't seem that we're doing a very good job at reconciling those in picking leaders, even in the corporate world, where it should be more data-driven.
Well, it'd be nice to be able to subject all these things to double-blind tests. I mean, that case of the magician C.C. Rouse, the professor at Princeton, has also done a study of this. It shows that if you have blind auditions, women do much better. I mean, that's a pretty good measure of discrimination. On the other hand, there's so many variables that go into the success of a CEO that you can't sort of say, hold this constant, put down the screen, and then we'll judge on everything else. So you're caught with situations where you can't make perfect judgments, but you can avoid some of the spurious things. I mean, it's much easier to be an attractive leader on an up market than a down market. You can also judge a leader by whether he or she puts in a system which corrects for this kind of problem that we saw with the financial system, where you didn't fully understand the risk and where it was born. So you can make partial judgments, and you can avoid spurious causation, but we'll never be to the point where you can do the perfect kind of test. And that, alas, is the nature of leadership, which is more of an art than a science. Yes, I guess this will probably be our last shot in the back.
I was wondering if you could comment on competition in leadership. And also, I find that a lot of times other people are competing with you, and whatnot might get in the way of someone being a good leader, and how people
should... You mean how people compete for leadership?
Well,
competition is healthy, but you can also have too much. In other words, Jack Welch tells the story that when Reginald Jones was competing the top three executives of subsidiary companies for who was going to be his successor at GE, he brought them all to headquarters for a year or so. And Welch's argument is all of us knew that we were being competed for the final slot. The competition was so intense that it actually was dysfunctional. You never opened your mouth, you never said a thing without thinking, how's that going to affect this? And so Welch says that when he was then making the same competition among the top three for his successor, GE, he left them in place of their separate companies. They knew they were still competing, but it didn't have, the competition wasn't as tight and so forth. So competition is clearly important, and as in many human things, it's useful, but too much competition under the wrong circumstances can be counterproductive, as I think that example illustrates. Well, I think we've exhausted our time, but not the subject. In any case, thank you all.